I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Doc says. Hello and welcome to the Doc Says on the Chairshot Radio Network. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of the WrestleMania Era book series and of the Doctor's Orders on lordsofpain.net. And from wherever you may be listening, I genuinely thank you for making me a part of your day. This episode is going to be a bit of a hodgepodge, and it will return to its shorter format as well. Today, I'm going to talk about NXT a little bit, WWE a lot, AEW, NWA, New Japan, and CM Punk. So, hold on to your butts. A lot to cover in a shorter period of time. Let's start with an observation. FYI, my bedtime routine since the advent of the WWE Network years ago has been to fall asleep to wrestling. I get comfortable, put wrestling on my tablet, and usually within 20 minutes, I'm out like a light. I don't currently have a network subscription and haven't paid WWE any money since the first quarter of the year, but I do have Hulu. I've kept up with Raw lately, and up until very recently, have been enjoying it. I think their streak ended when they started focusing on Survivor Series hype, but that's a topic for next week. What I haven't been keeping track of at all is SmackDown. The Kofi Kingston burial, yes, I use that word intentionally, as he's quite literally been buried into the familiar comforts of the always up and down WWE tag team division since getting squashed by Brock Lesnar on the Fox premiere, gave me no reason to seek out the Blue Brand. However, people talked up the show that NXT invaded a couple of weeks ago, so I thought I'd Hulu it and see what all the hype was about. More on the stuff that made people say it was great next week when Survivor Series comes into focus. What I want to focus on is actually Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, who I've sort of sworn off talking about for the most part for the last long while. The observation is this. Rewind the clock a few months, and on this show, I had a real problem with Chris Jericho being the first AEW champion, primarily because in staying consistent with my primary WWE gripe over the past few years, he's an old guy getting pushed above younger peers in their athletic primes. Brock is not as old and is still in his athletic prime-ish, granted, but he's a part-time act who is kept on an MMA-like leash that prevents his matches from reaching an emotionally engaging ceiling. And this is the kicker to bring these two guys into focus. He's doing the exact same thing he was doing 5 years ago. Turn on WWE TV today. Cue up Raw from 5 years ago. What about the Lesnar act has changed? Name one detail. It's the same thing. Over and over again. The part-time champion, the same Heyman promo, the same type of match without deviation. It's gimmicky. It always was. There's no meat left on that bone to pick. I felt like Jericho was going to hold the AEW championship in a holding pattern, like Brock has done for much of the last half decade with the WWE or Universal titles, preventing the product he's leading from moving confidently forward into the new era. Or at least, that potential was there for Jericho. My opinion on Jericho, as I mentioned on last week's show, changed once AEW's weekly program started. And why? Because he's reinvented himself again. He's there every week, and he's doing a great job in his role. He's elevating others on a near-weekly basis, It's just working, and you'd be hard-pressed to find many who disagree with that. You turn on SmackDown or Raw recently, what happened to the draft, by the way, and you see Brock bouncing around while Paul Heyman cuts a variation of the exact same promo he's cut a dozen or so times per year since Brock ended the streak. Television characters evolve. Chris Jericho evolved. Lesnar is a television character who hasn't. So when we get into this asinine conversation about people being hypocritical for being okay with something happening in AEW but not in WWE, can we please consider context? This asinine conversation is my hill to die on. And beware, ladies and gentlemen, my keyboard warrior bona fides, when you try to battle me on a hill I'm willing to die on. To quote the great Jimmy King of WrestleCrap lore, I will rule you. I will reign supreme. I'm crusading to put an end to idiocy in the internet wrestling community, and there's nothing more idiotic than these, well, if it happened in WWE, you'd hate it tweets. Wait, what's your name again? Twitter user making that claim? It doesn't matter what your name is. Shut your mouth and wash your hands to clean off the stupid tongue firmly planted in cheek there. Because I'm not afraid to make you uncomfortable. I'm not afraid to rattle. Gonna herd your candy asses into a Twitter barn like cattle. Come out spewing that crap again, and I'll get called for technicals like sheet. Then herd your asses right back into the Twitter barn, guaranteed. If you smell what the doc is cooking. While we're on the topic of WWE, I've been thinking a lot lately about legacy. A month or so ago, Ray Cash, who, if listening to this, is either fuming or laughing right now, joined me for a really good conversation about the changes in wrestling that will make determining legacies different moving forward than it has been in the time, for instance, when I was writing my book. We talked a little bit about Seth Rollins in that podcast, who I questioned after reviewing his run in 2014 and 15 for the Decade in Review series recently, specifically as it pertains to the perception of him now, given what he accomplished then. I wondered aloud why he wasn't in that respected place that wrestlers of his stature typically are after being in a top-level position in the company for five or more years, as he has been. Remember, Rollins has been a consistent top guy in WWE for as long as Dave Bautista, whose peak run lasted between 2005 and 2010. Rollins has been on top longer than Mick Foley, Steve Austin, and The Rock. And for clarity's sake, by on top, I mean he's been one of the top two or three active roster members, always positioned in prime spots for the big four, and never having those stretches of relative irrelevance in the top five conversation like, say, Kevin Owens, or the artist formerly known as Dean Ambrose. Yet the appreciation for him doesn't seem to be there. That got me thinking more about social media, which I think has been a driving force in strange narratives like the hypocrisy nonsense lambasted previously. Now, by the way, I'm not suggesting hypocrisy doesn't exist in the Twitterverse. I've experienced it for a long time. Long before Twitter came to be, I experienced it as a forum member, as a columnist who got a lot of emails and comments and other platforms beyond Twitter and Facebook. So, I mean, I get it. But I'm suggesting that taking context out of the situation negates the hypocrisy argument much of the time. Anyhow, there have obviously been talks of how social media and the constant stream of consciousness in our society today affects the way we perceive stars in the major pro sports leagues around the world. The liberalization of society at large has its drawbacks. It's got some positives, has its drawbacks, among which is we are really quick to overreact, letting one thing about an athlete's career drive the narrative about his or her legacy. Michael Jordan's hyper-competitiveness is what made him an icon, but that was background noise when he was at his apex. Today, we'd know about it, we'd overanalyze it, and it could very well have changed how he was perceived by what was mostly an adoring public back in the day. That's realistic, right? Well, the internet wrestling community has existed prominently and has influenced wrestling prominently for what I'd argue as longer than what we've seen with other sports or entertainment entities in the internet era. As someone who enjoys a rousing talk of legacy, and with a book written about the WrestleMania era to contextualize the greatest of the great to back that up, I think we might be underestimating the ability for modern social media to negatively impact perception. It's not rumor anymore either, and I think that's where it used to be. Rumor once upon a time in our community would doom a wrestler. Look at all the backstage rumors about politicking and what it did to the perception of Triple H and to a lesser extent Jeff Jarrett and later in his prime, John Cena. Rumors were very, very powerful and more powerful than facts in the 2000s. I say that because look, Steve Austin beat his wife. That was a fact. Today, he'd be a pariah, yet back then he was more of a hero than Triple H, whose greatest crime was falling for his boss's daughter and undermining a few careers, most of which, frankly, turned out fine anyway. So that brings me back to Seth Rollins, who was struggling to gain a foothold in the hearts of diehard fans in the way that we'd expect a top babyface to do. As in, he was never over, like Daniel Bryan or CM Punk, probably not even 75% is over, if you're judging by weekly crowd reactions. But he was still a legitimately popular fan favorite who only seemed to need that little spark to put him over the top. That was until he started spouting off on social media this year. I felt for a long time that his ceiling, after watching him get through the Triple H feud, was some legitimate repair done to his relationship with an audience that had truly bought into him as the Triple H of his era, at least in regards to his heel bona fides. Then watched him rise higher up the protagonistic totem pole with the storyline reunion with Ambrose, and eventually Reigns, and follow that with his triumph as a fighting Intercontinental Champion after his record runtime in the Gauntlet match on Raw in the winter of 2018. And do all that only to basically still be questioned as a top babyface by the time he got around to what he did earlier this year by many of the people whose opinions I respect most in the IWC. Even my pal Dave Fenichel, who isn't Ray Cash or Samuel Plan levels of WWE Homer, and I say that endearingly, my friends, but is still by and large a WWE Homer himself. And as Dave Fenichel would frequently tell me, that guy isn't a babyface, speaking of Rollins. I felt for a long time, then, that Seth's ceiling was to reach the HBK Light level of respected veteran star babyface with a catchphrase that people would get behind. That still may happen someday, but with Roman Reigns firmly entrenched in the old Cena role of controversial top guy who WWE won't turn no matter what, because reasons, no matter how profitable in the short term and the long term, such a creative, quote-unquote, risk could potentially be. WWE has no reason not to turn Seth if that's the role he's better suited to play, that being as the antagonist. Now, I don't begin to understand the modern WWE creative process. Remember, I often refer to it as a non-process, which is why I struggle to buy into ideas like in 2019, WWE could possibly be setting up Kofi Kingston for something huge in the upcoming Mania season, and find it far more likely that they feel like they've fulfilled their duty to push him to the top because we asked for it so loudly, and now they're going to just keep him confined to his good little spot in the mid-card. That said, my lack of understanding of their process aside, Seth Rollins hasn't done himself a single favor with his social media crusade to be a company guy. Here's the weird thing. I genuinely appreciate authenticity. And you may know that Rollins is my favorite WWE wrestler of this generation, a title he's earned by both being the best, in my opinion, and by earning my respect through his various excellent stories told in an era when so few great stories get told in WWE. But isn't it weird that his honesty is probably the thing that has bitten him in the butt the most? Who is his target audience in WWE? It's us. The diehard fan is the fan most likely to get behind a smaller, faster wrestler with a flashy moveset like him. Barring a spark that can get him to reach Punk and Bryan levels, branching his status beyond the diehard bubble and out into the broader audience, Rollins was going to be remembered based mostly on how we remember him. Like it or not, the internet wrestling community shapes legacies for guys like that. Bryan not so much, because he got over in a broader context. He reached beyond wrestling. Rollins killed his own standing with the diehard fans because of how he flippantly treated the disgruntlement of that very fan base. I get it. I admire it in a way. He's standing up for what he believes in, trying to be a leader during an odd time for contemporary WWE stars, and I applaud that. But he did that. He did it in this sort of classic overzealous nature that defines mine and younger generations. He overstepped using that platform. And that doesn't really, that platform doesn't give you the chance to set a very good tone. He went after Ospreay, who diehard fans the world over felt was having the best year among his peers. He went after Omega, who has earned, through some pretty brilliant work, a lot of admiration and respect from the very fans that Rollins would be most likely to attract. I think that, quite frankly, some have underestimated the reach that diehard fans have in this day and age, because diehard fans largely comprise the wrestling fan base. There's just a lot of diehard fans now that want to watch wrestling because, hey man, the WrestleMania era is approaching its 40th year. Generations, mine, the one under mine, the one above mine, the one that's now in college, in high school. I mean, my goodness. Generations consider WWE to be a pastime. For pro wrestling to be a pastime. They love it. And they want the business to be as satisfying to them now as it was then. Negativity may be a plague on modern media and society at large, and certainly social media is a driving force behind that. But that's not limited to pro wrestling fans. That's a wider issue. Wrestling fans want to be satisfied by their time and money spent. CM Punk understood that, and he capitalized on it. Daniel Bryan understood that, and he capitalized on it. Seth Rollins apparently doesn't understand that, and thus has not been able to capitalize on it. If anything, he's taken the opposite to heart. He's less pro-wrestler and more pro-corporation. And that ain't gonna fly when supporting the corporation that a lot of people want so badly to rebel against right now. WWE is like Big Pharma in healthcare. Publicly supporting it in this messed up, controversy-ridden era is a death knell for an aspiring television hero. Seth Rollins dug his own grave with the very public that could have put him in a higher echelon of star. Now, that's not a very big deal to me, granted, especially if WWE does turn him heel. Maybe he's just more natural that way. And if that's the case, his career would remind me a lot of Edge's. Edge, another all-time favorite of mine, was never much of a top babyface. He had his moments, but his career will be remembered by his heel accomplishments because he never connected that organically with the people in a protagonist light. He was much stronger with the dark side, and that's okay. That's still good enough for where I had him rated when the WrestleMania era came out as the 11th most successful WWE career of all time, or the 11th most successful career of the WrestleMania era. Maybe that's Seth's destiny too. I mean, didn't hold Edge back that much historically, did it? No matter if Seth keeps up his current trajectory, you know, if he keeps up his current trajectory, Seth Rollins is going to be remembered as an all-time great. But he may not resonate with people on that level. Just like Edge, for a lot of people, just doesn't resonate on the same level that a someone like a CM Punk or Daniel Bryan does, because that visceral sort of reaction, that visceral I have to watch this guy type thing, just never came to fruition for him. It wasn't who he was. Still a great pro wrestler who accomplished a hell of a lot. So maybe that's Seth. But remember this, for all of Rollins' faults on social media, he still got two of the top five matches in WWE this year. He won the Rumble for the first time. He beat Lesnar at Mania. He beat him again in the SummerSlam main event. I just think that the social media bug bit him, and bit him hard, to the point now where, you know, people are legitimately disliking his ass, and it's weird. He could have been out there praising Ospreay and Omega, championing what they had done in the ring, and really putting a spotlight on it, saying, hey, good for you guys. He could have done the same with Moxley's decision to leave and how he left and what he had to say. He could have supported that. And if it's not being honest for him to do so, then fair enough. But, you know, he's a made man in WWE at this point. The guy got shot with a social media high-caliber round when he cheated on his fiance and had his wang splashed all over the internet. And it was made clear that he's got a reinforced bulletproof vest in WWE's eyes when no one batted an eyelash about that. Why lean into the narrative that diehard fans were rebelling against Seth Rollins? Why? Why Seth Rollins? That's something he'll have to address in the future, but I think in doing so, he unquestionably changed his own future. It'll be fascinating to see how he's remembered years from now. He may never get the credit that he deserves. That's the reality of social media, which I think wrestlers would be best to think of like I have. The Doc Chad Matthews is a pen name, and it's the real me, but it's the real me unfiltered. But my real-life accounts on social media, they're very filtered, and they're measured, because my professional career in part depends on my being careful about what I say. That's the reality for all of us right now. I wish Rollins had better recognized that before continually sparking the ire of the people who are best suited to get him over as much as he could be. Let's talk about CM Punk. Wow. A lot of talk about CM Punk on social media right now. Look, you know as well as I do, he's getting back in that ring. Don't kid yourselves. Rock eventually did. And The Rock is the ultimate example of someone who never had to, but just wanted to, because there's nothing like pro wrestling. That's why all of us keep coming back, even if a lot of us don't like what we're watching anymore. First, Punk is going to do his FS1 show that I personally couldn't give a monkey crap about. Later, he'll do a promo in the ring, and that'll be the deal sealer, folks. Once he gets in that ring, in front of a big live audience, and cuts a promo, feels that energy, seriously, that might be the last thing WWE can do to save its relationship in the short term with diehard fans who are disgruntled. Punk started a lot of the movement that's led us to where we are. He was quite literally the voice of the voiceless diehard wrestling fan who just wanted WWE to change the way it looked at things and alter its product. Punk accomplished a lot. He's one of the most influential stars of the decade, if not ever, in WWE. I mean that, and if you really want to question me on that, hit me up at the DocLOP on Twitter and we'll talk about it. CM Punk is to WWE what Steph Curry is to the NBA. And that carries a lot of weight with me and others. But come on, back to WWE? AEW was the perfect landing spot for that guy. And it's a huge, huge missed opportunity on AEW's part that they didn't find a way to make that happen. The moment he cuts a promo in WWE, what he can offer AEW loses immediately 50% more of its value. There's no replacing a first. And Punk's first promo in a live wrestling ring is going to be must-see TV. I'm at my lowest point as a WWE fan that I've ever been. just in terms of time committed to it and money. And frankly, even if I quit watching it indefinitely, Punk's televised appearance, just to hear how he'd handle it, would be something I'd come back to watch in a heartbeat. AEW could have had that. Should have had that. My goodness. Think about that. I'm not even sure that AEW exists without the influence of CM Punk on the pro wrestling industry this decade. He showed that independent wrestlers could make the big time and thrive. That what it means to thrive has changed so much in the 6 years since he left WWE is fascinating in its own right. But with all the things he had to say about WWE in the past, AEW offered a prime opportunity for him to stick it to them. I mean, really stick it to them. And in a way that would have been a game changer for AEW, which I love, by the way. But come on, you know and I know that if AEW really wants to take the next step, it's going to have to play that little game with WWE and get CM Punk into the fold at some point. Punk's first promo would draw huge for AEW. I'm talking about doubling their audience. I believe that. His first match would pop a very impressive eye-opening buy rate for that company, I think. The sad thing is, when it happens for WWE, it probably doesn't change a damn thing. WWE will blow his return match, probably against somebody he's already wrestled, and it won't be the same visceral kind of experience that people will remember forever. At least not in my opinion. CM Punk with AEW is like LeBron going back to Cleveland. CM Punk in WWE is like LeBron going to the Lakers. Mixed feelings there for me, genuinely. I don't know how I'm going to react when it gets a little deeper into it. New Japan's Wrestle Kingdom 14 main event is going to take place across a couple of nights. And I'm not feeling it. The double main renders the match I was most looking forward to seeing in that main event spot, Kazuchika Okada versus Kota Ibushi, to secondary status. I get that they have two nights to fill this go-round. They got to fill the dome twice, and that's cool. But there were other routes to take, and I'm really not that fond at this point of the route they've chosen. Unifying the championships on the second night is cool and all, I suppose. But Ibushi versus Okada was just the perfect top match at Wrestle Kingdom in my view. And it'll take some time or something significant happening in New Japan for me to change my mind. It strikes me very much as the equivalent for New Japan of adding Charlotte to the WrestleMania 35 main event, taking something that's pretty much perfect the way it is and adding a new dynamic unnecessarily for reasons I'm unsure of. As usual, I'm sure the matches will be great. But what separates one amazing New Japan match from the next is the anticipation of it, along with the stakes. Ibushi versus Okada could still be as epic, I guess, but you'd have to think going on last on night two of the Wrestle Kingdom show would have ramped up the epicness, and the stakes are still high on the night that it's taking place, night one. But there's no replacing the vibe that comes from being on last at the biggest show of the year. Thoughts on NXT War Games? The card is incomplete as we speak, but I'm not that high on the concept, to be frank. Year one, I felt, was a production mess that I really didn't enjoy that much. Year two, because of the Undisputed Era, worked much better, and I think that, frankly, that one was actually great. NXT throws these War Games matches together pretty well, and last year's was really fun. But I feel like, at this point, the match beyond, if you will, is going to get done much better elsewhere before long, and now NXT's version just feels a little lukewarm to me. Having two of them on the same night makes me even colder on the concept. They're hard enough to do, and hard enough to engage with when there's only one. And War Games ain't Hell in a Cell, folks. It's not a ladder match. Less is very much more. If I do watch, it'll be really because of Finn Balor versus Matt Riddle. That I can get behind without much hype. It's very intriguing to me on multiple levels. Finn Balor in NXT is like a catchy song on the radio. Riddle has been money at TakeOver this year, so he's an ideal first opponent back on that stage for the NXT icon returned. Not having kept up that closely with the Yellow brand lately, I can make a case for either one of them winning, and that's usually a good thing for a match's ability to fully engage. Riddle seems like a prime candidate to challenge for the NXT title in an upcoming TakeOver, and a prime candidate to become the champion at that. I kind of wonder how the USA Network dynamic will affect future decisions like that. Adam Cole and the Undisputed Era perfect right now to ramp up NXT's place in the wrestling universe. Riddle seems perfectly poised to be the next babyface champ, along with the Velveteen Dream. But Balor, he just came back, and it doesn't seem likely that he won't win, so maybe a tainted win for Balor is the right call. Quick little shout out to the NWA Power Show. It's the perfect way to go to sleep. Its theme song is constantly stuck in my head, and when I say that it's a perfect way to go to sleep, I mean that in the complimentary fashion that I referenced at the beginning of the show. I usually watch it across Tuesday and Wednesday nights. Any predictions from listeners on what their upcoming pay-per-view card's going to look like? I'm certainly down for $20 in December, but I'd like to know what I'm paying for. Cheers to AEW. That's my closing thought, which delivered another great show last week on Wednesday Night Dynamite, after what I felt was a home run, go home show ahead of their pay-per-view. I thought they hit the reset button nicely for the upcoming cycle that won't have a pay-per-view featured for a while, answering the call to give us more character building. It was a very setup based night. It felt like an Attitude Era Raw to me, which was far less back in the day about match quality and far more about building to matches so that the quality could eventually be maximized later. There are short-term situations filled with intrigue right now, and there are long-term intrigue for matches to be wrestled further into the future. I gotta admit, I really do love that company right now. That's, to me, how pro wrestling should be booked week to week, and it's been a lot of fun to re-engage with a weekly show after all these years of sort of getting to a different sort of format with my viewing and fandom. So that's going to do it for this week on The Doc Says. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I would certainly welcome your thoughts on the various topics brought up today on social media at The Doc LOP. If you want to go more long form, please write me an email at cmdoclop@gmail.com. I would enjoy a longer form type of communication with you, quite frankly. So if there are any questions, hit me up. If you have any comments, let me know. And I hope you have a great upcoming week. The audio prescription for all things professional wrestling can be filled next Sunday, same place, same time, on the Chair Shot Radio Network. Check out all of the shows here on the Chair Shot Radio Network. Hashtag always use your head. Catch you next time.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the prepare for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania.